From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's every generation's lament that the children are spoiled, sassy, and, well, ungrateful. The truth is that growing up has never been an easy rite of passage for children or parents, despite all the folklore that suggests otherwise. Tonight on Point, the history of childhood in America, from Puritan times to the DVD generation, and how today's children stack up. But first, we begin tonight in Iraq, where the U.S. military has moved deeper into Fallujah today. Around the country, dozens died in car bombings and running battles. Insurgents kidnapped three relatives of Iraqi Prime Minister Iyad Alawi and threatened to behead them unless the siege of Fallujah is lifted. But in Fallujah, the U.S. offensive with Iraqi troops in support ground forward. Babak Deganpeshe is Baghdad bureau chief for Newsweek magazine. He's now embedded with the Marines' 3rd Battalion in Fallujah. I asked him what he had seen today.
Still relatively intense fighting. The Marine unit that I'm with had an objective here in the city, a mosque that they were trying to raid, and which they did reach that, and they did raid this mosque. But along the way, it was, you know, there were quite a few intense gun battles. There were quite a few rocket and mortar attacks also coming in.
Is it clear what kind of opponent U.S. and Iraqi troops are up against in Fallujah and how close they are, if indeed they're close, to taking control of the entire city?
They definitely have been making progress through the city, but I guess one of the very strange things about this fight, you know, being an unconventional fight, is that the enemy is largely invisible. There are 3-4-man teams, 1-2-man teams that pop up in the streets and the alleyways and engage the Marines, but for the most part, it's an invisible enemy. There's snipers on rooftops taking shots at them. There are people from further distances who are firing mortars and rockets at them. So for some of these Marines, it's a very frustrating fight not to be able to see their enemy and sort of take them on directly as they would in a conventional war.
And Babek, do the soldiers that you're with have a sense of what victory or completion will mean exactly?
Well, I think, a lot of these Marines, really, they're focused on what they would like to see, which is, you know, finishing up this battle and getting home. The unit that I'm with is scheduled to go home in January, and really that's the prize they're focused on more than complete stabilization of Fallujah and holding elections in January. I mean, they're obviously doing their best to fight this fight and to weed these insurgents out of the city, but I think most of these Marines are relating to this fight on a personal level, that it just brings them one step closer to home.
We've heard reports of the U.S. and Iraqi troops engaging with insurgents in or around mosques. Have mosques been bombed? Have they been overtaken?
Yes, actually, one of the objectives that we went to today that our unit did raid was a mosque, and apparently the intel had showed that this mosque was a weapons cache, and it was hit with 2 500-pound bombs before we went in. But when we did raid, there were weapons found inside. There were RPG tubes and, ammo and other things that were found inside that I suppose would warrant an attack if it was being used as a weapons cache. But I suppose the larger question is what the repercussions of those kinds of attacks are among the Iraqi public. If word gets out that mosques are being hit, it is bound to have a very negative reaction amongst the Iraqi public. One interesting thing that we came across in the mosque today was some literature that would hint at foreign fighters being here. There were Urdu language letters and pamphlets and things like that that hinted at possibly Pakistani fighters being here, that there were jihadi pamphlets calling for war against the U.S., and also there were some jihadi pamphlets from Indonesian Muslim groups there. So there is some indication that there are foreign fighters present.
And is it Iraqi troops going into the mosques or U.S. Marines or both?
It's a bit of both, actually. The unit that I'm with does have a handful of Iraqi troops with them, and they did a joint raid on the mosque.
What's your sense overall of the role the Iraqi troops have played in Fallujah, Babek? Have they been significant, important? Have they been good partners to the U.S. troops there?
I think they have been good partners, but again, you have to understand that I'm seeing one slice of a bigger pie, so I can't really address this as a whole. But from what I've seen, the plan has been to let the Marines take the initial charge and then let the Iraqi troops sort of do the follow-up work and holding security and perhaps doing the more delicate and sometimes tougher task of talking to civilians and perhaps getting information and help from them and weeding out some of these other insurgents who may be left in the city.
And do the troops you're with think about, or are they talking about the backside of this assault, when they begin to wrap up, and what that means? Who's going to stay behind and keep order when the big force of U.S. troops presumably pulls out?
Well, they're really focused on doing the fight on the ground. I mean, it has been a couple of days of quite intense fighting. I mean, I think they would be happy with any political force that can come in and stabilize, and the reports are that Mr. Alawi has worked with leaders in the region to handpick a cabinet, so to say, out, or a group of people who would come in and take power right away in Fallujah. So there isn't a vacuum that would allow these insurgents to step up again.
And Babak Deganpeche, do you have the sense that the fighting is now approaching some kind of conclusion, or does it feel possible that U.S. troops could get bogged down in Fallujah for days or weeks in the close fighting, narrow alleyways and the rest?
It's really tough to say. I mean, I suppose one thing is that those fighters who had chosen to make it a stand, who did choose to fight to the death, I mean, it certainly seems like, you know, the Marines have been engaging, well, and killing a lot of them in the past couple of days. But it's really a gray area now that it seems it could be a quite dangerous period where, you know, there could be insurgents hiding all over the city and snipers taking pot shots and laying IEDs for Marines and Army troops here in the city. So it is really difficult to say when things would actually come to any sort of conclusion here.
And can you imagine when the civilian population in its bulk might be able to return?
That's also difficult to say, actually. The region that we've been in, the Jolan neighborhood, the civilians have completely cleared out. We have not seen a single civilian in the past couple of days. I would imagine that if the fighting does taper off, that would be some sort of encouragement for the civilian population to come back. But again, that would also depend on how successful the new government or the new people who come to run Fallujah are at convincing people that the fighting has stopped.
And finally, Babak, when people do return to their homes, from what you can see, what are they going to find? Is there widespread destruction, or is it just around the edges?
Well, the areas that we've seen, I mean, you know, obviously the areas where there's been intense fighting, yes, there has been a lot of destruction. There's been a lot of walls knocked down, you know, electrical wires torn up. But I think the from what the Marine commanders are telling us, that immediately following what they are sort of scheduling as a combat phase, they're planning for reconstruction teams to come in here and help rebuild the city, or at least try to fund some of that. But to some extent, parts of this area that we passed through had already been sort of fortified and built up in defensive positions by the fighters, and had been damaged somewhat by that. But again, probably a matter of days after the fighting ends for the reconstruction to start in some form.
We'll hope things can get to that chapter soon. Babak Deganpeche, thank you very much for joining us there. Be safe.
Thank you for having me on.
Newsweek Baghdad Bureau Chief Babak Deganpeche is embedded with the Marines 3rd Battalion. He spoke with me from Fallujah. When I was a child, I walked 5 miles in the snow to get to school. Kids today have it so easy. That's the nostalgia. But reality is something quite different, says historian Stephen Mintz in a new book entitled Huck's Raft. The truth is that growing up in America has never been easy. And every era, today's included, has its own distinctive understanding of what childhood is. Mintz lays out his thesis in rich detail of childhood in sin-obsessed Puritan households, in times of slavery and pioneer hardship, in wartime when children were orphaned or went off to fight in wars themselves. And then there's childhood today, with all the pressures for kids to grow up fast but to become real adults slowly. This hour, we're talking about growing up in America across the centuries, the many faces of childhood from Puritan times to the present. You can join the conversation tonight. Are you aware just how differently children were seen in eras past, how different childhood was? Is it better today, worse, or just different again? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Houston, Texas, is Stephen Mintz, professor of history at the University of Houston, co-chair of the Council on Contemporary Families, and author of the new book, Huck's Raft, A History of American Childhood. Stephen Mintz, welcome. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
This is a delightful tour across centuries with glimpses into styles of childhood that I have to admit I'd never really thought about or focused on. And the first thing you throw at us is the simple but kind of jarring observation that childhood has meant very different things in different eras of American history. I wish you could paint a bit of a picture of that, Stephen Mintz.
Well, if we could throw ourselves backwards 300 years, we would see that everything that we take for granted about childhood was the exact opposite. We believe in sentimentalizing childhood. We're all nostalgic for our growing up years. People 300 years ago were never sentimental about childhood and never were nostalgic about the past.
They weren't sentimental or nostalgic, meaning what? It was hardship and woe?
If they wrote an autobiography, they skipped over their childhood years. It was as if it was an invisible period of life. We think that kids need a stable environment and a secure nurturer. They had exactly the opposite point of view. Children would move frequently from their home of birth into other people's home and then back again. And they assumed that that was normal. We think that kids shouldn't work. They believe that kids should begin to work at a very early age. We believe that kids should be treated gently and with indulgence, and they believe the exact opposite.
Sternly and with rigor.
Exactly.
And, Mr. Historian, who grew up better, the kids in that backwards to our standard time or now?
Well, my argument is that in every imaginable way, childhood is better today, except in those ways that matter most.
Ouch.
And let me try to explain that for a moment. What I mean by that is that in the past, children played active roles in all the crucial events of American history. They were active contributors to their economy, to their families, to their society. We have segregated the young in a realm wholly separate from adults, and we have developed a history of children in our own minds that distorts our understanding of children's potential. My argument is that children are much more adaptable, much more resilient, and much more capable than our society believes.
But you're saying they're not given the chance to exercise that today. You title the book Huck's Raft. Of course, the reference is to Huckleberry Finn. Why Huck's Raft? What are you referring to there, Stephen Mintz?
Because we in this society for a century have had a fantasy of childhood, that it should be an odyssey of discovery, that it should be a period of risk and freedom and experimentation and growth. But what I see is that today we have created the exact opposite of that. While we indulge children in many ways, that is, parents lavish more money on children than at any time in history, children live constrained, regimented, highly supervised lives that aren't as pleasurable as many of the lives of children in the past.
This sounds like the opposite of the Huckleberry Finn legend, and yet you caution us against over-sentimentalizing childhood in the past as well.
Well, let me give you an example. By the time Mark Twain, that is Sam Clemens, was 12 years old...
In Hannibal, Missouri.
He had witnessed three murders and had lost three siblings and his father. By the time he was 18, he had worked in four or five different jobs in cities as remote as New York City and St. Louis and Washington, D.C. He lived, by our standards, a precocious life, but also a very stressful life.
Bring in the grief counselors and the psychiatrists.
And we would assume that this would lead to all kinds of psychological problems, but in fact what it did is it contributed to a kind of richness and a voice that we all would envy.
We have a lot more that we want to hear tonight. Stephen Mintz is with us. He's professor of history at the University of Houston. He's author of the terrific new book, Huck's Raft, A History of American Childhood. We're looking tonight at growing up in America across the centuries, the many faces of childhood, from Puritan times to the present. You can join this conversation. Are you aware just how differently children were seen in eras past? And how different is childhood today from your own childhood? Would you rather have grown up in colonial times, in frontier days, in the Leave It to Beaver 50s? And what's the essence of a good childhood? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about growing up in America across the centuries. My guest, Stephen Mintz, author of the new book, Huck's Raft, A History of American Childhood. You can join us as well. Would you rather have grown up in colonial times, in frontier days, in the Leave It to Beaver 50s? And what's the essence of a good childhood? Do kids have it today? Has the majority of any generation of children ever really had it? And what about parenting? Is it a prisoner of its times, of fads and styles and cultural moments? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Stephen Mintz, you've already laid out a lot for us to dive into here, but I don't want to skip over the wonderful history that you've laid out here. You lay out, as I read it, three or four major eras or periods when childhood was seen in different ways in American history. Could you walk us through those?
Okay. The colonial era is the era of what I would call pre-modern childhood. Childhood was viewed as a state of deficiency, and children need to be rushed through it as quickly as possible. The Puritans, for example, believed that crawling was animal-like because children were walking on all fours. And so they forced them to stand at a very early age. They put them in walkers so that they wouldn't crawl. And they even would put wooden or metal rods down their spines to make sure that they had an erect posture. They believed that standing upright was being morally upright. And so it seemed crucial for children to stand. They also believed that it was animal-like to be unable to talk. And so they tried to convince their children to speak as quickly as possible. In addition, they put children to work at an early age, and they moved children from the home into relatives' or strangers' homes and back and forth.
This is the Puritan era, very different. As you said before, almost the opposite of now. I don't know what it's like to be a historian trying to get at this, but do we have a sense of whether or not children it thrived on this or enjoyed it? I mean, you tell one tale of children kidnapped by Indians who didn't want to go back home when they were finally discovered.
Well, childhood evoked many different responses from young kids. Let me give you an example.
Mm-hmm.
A young boy named Peter Williamson lived in Edinburgh, Scotland, and one day he was playing by the wharfs, and he was kidnapped. And Robert Louis Stevenson would later write a book about his experience called Kidnapped.
Mm-hmm.
But the real Peter Williamson winds up in New Jersey. He's taken to Philadelphia, and he's sold. There is no question that for many children, and our guess is that is a majority of children in colonial America, childhood was a period of unfreedom, either as a slave or as an indentured servant or as an apprentice. This could be extremely harsh.
Kidnapped and taken across the sea sounds pretty rough, and yet people, just in the way of biology in the world, they come through it. But I guess the same question, is there a standard to put up against this to know if children were better adjusted or not coming out of that kind of childhood than today?
Well, the point I would stress is that much of our contemporary psychological theory would suggest that children who grew up in the pre-industrial world grew up as emotional cripples. For example, children were often swaddled, that is, they were wrapped in bandages, and sometimes they were even left on a nail against the wall.
Mm.
And we would think that this would deprive children of the kind of emotional and physical stimulation which is absolutely necessary to be well-adjusted. And yet, that is the kind of childhood, probably, infancy that William Shakespeare went through. Again, what I'd like to stress is that children are more adaptable, more resilient than we often assume.
After all, these people grew up to be the same fathers and mothers of the nation that we now celebrate. By the middle of the 18th century, you say a new set of attitudes about childhood were emerging that came to define modern childhood.
Yes, two different ideas emerge, which will have enormous consequences for the future and remain intact even today. The first is that childhood is a special, vulnerable stage that needs to be separated from the adult world.
Mm.
And the second idea is that childhood needs to be prolonged in order to prepare children for changing adult roles. these two ideas, the idea of childhood vulnerability and the idea of prolonging childhood dependence, have governed our conception, our ideal of childhood, for the last 150 years. Now, let me add to that that while this was true of urban middle-class children, for other children, that is, for the vast majority of American children, life was just the opposite. The Industrial Revolution made children's labor much more valuable in the past. It's not an accident that at the very first factory in America, Samuel Slater's mill in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, the original workforce consisted of 5 boys and 2 girls, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12.
Wow. They were cheap, they were malleable, they did what they were told, more or less, I suppose.
What Samuel Slater said is that by pouring water on their heads, he could get them to work 3 times harder than any adults.
Oh, jeez. You describe throughout this history of childhood in America the importance, I mean, there's geography, there's religion, there are ethnic factors that come into play, but above all, status, socioeconomic or class really matters in terms of the child's experience.
Today, many Americans think that family structure is the key to understanding differences, and there is no evidence to support that. There is no sharp difference in children based on divorce or family structure, whether they come from a two-parent household or a single-parent household. The difference that seems to be overarching is family income.
In determining what that child's experience is, and yet there are common factors. You describe coming out of that modern childhood, what is now a kind of postmodern vision of childhood that the country is still perhaps in transition to, but how would you define that?
Well, what's fascinating is that a campaign began about 150 years ago to universalize the ideal of a middle-class childhood. That is, to make all children spend their years up to 16, 17, 18 in school and out of the workforce. As late as recently as 1900, only something like 6% of 17-year-olds were still in school. Today, the overwhelming majority, a vast majority, are in school. But just as that kind of childhood finally achieved success, and that was not until the late 1950s and 1960s, something very different began to emerge. And it emerged for the same reasons that our society is changing right now. Let me give you some examples.
Yeah.
One of the forces that's transforming our world today is globalization.
Mm-hmm.
And nowhere is globalization more apparent than among kids. In America, 25% of American children are the children of immigrants. Mm-hmm. That is, they are either immigrants themselves or their parents immigrated. This is the largest percentage of children who are immigrants in American history, and it means that childhood is more diverse than it has ever been. Another development that we often think about but don't connect to children is the rise of the new economy. The new economy has had many effects on American society, but the most notable is income disparities. We have now a huge divide in childhood experience based on social class. Growing up in Scarsdale, growing up in Brookline is completely different than growing up in the South Bronx. The third development that created a kind of new child was the information revolution. Beginning in the 1970s and accelerating in the 1980s with the deregulation of media, there was a growing effort at niche broadcasting, focusing, targeting at specific groups. One of those groups would be kids. And manufacturers began to market their products with all the wiles that they would aim at adults at kids.
Making them real consumers.
For the first time, instead of selling to their parents, they sold directly to kids, even going so far, as you know, to have television shows that were simply half-hour-long commercials for products. And then there was a fourth development that I should mention, and that is a demographic revolution unprecedented in American history. That is, today, the average family has around 2 children. But in fact, about half of all children have no siblings. This is the first time in history that that has ever been the case. And it's no doubt made childhood a lot different. It's led to the rise of something we call the play date, right?
Right. You don't have make an appointment to play.
Yes.
And who doesn't know it these days with parent schedules and work and all the rest? And with all of that, you end up coming to this conclusion of a deep underlying contradiction in young lives today, maturing physiologically earlier than ever before, but cut out of interaction with real adult society longer than ever before, kept in a kind of very long adolescence.
Right. And when do you grow up today? We've seen a new stage of life emerging in recent years. I guess we call it early adulthood, but that's not a wonderful phrase. And it means that most people don't become adults until their 30s. Back in the 1950s, it's hard to believe this, but it's true, most women, the largest number of women, married at the age of 17.
Boom,
half of all women were married by 20. Most males were married by the age of 22. The teenage years meant something completely different when you would become a full adult at the end of your teen years. Today, you have at least another decade of a kind of extended adolescence.
Stephen Mintz, stand by. A lot of callers want to join our conversation. We're talking about the history of childhood in America with Stephen Mintz. He's author of Huck's Raft. You can join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255. Joel is calling from Greensboro, North Carolina. Hi, Joel. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to contrast a little bit the childhood of my own children with my childhood.
Yeah.
60s. Particularly the issue of the loss of freedom of young children today. When I was a kid, we went off on our bicycles for hours. We played in the woods, girls and boys. My mother would say, be home at dinner, and between whatever time it was in dinner, she didn't know where I was. We'd ride to the store, we'd play in the creek, we'd build forts, we'd do this, we'd do that.
Your version of the Huckleberry Finn life.
It was just a middle class, you know, Southern life.
Mm-hmm.
And every house in my neighborhood had a lot of children, so there was always football games and basketball, and you didn't learn sports by being on a team. You learned sports in the neighborhood. There was no fear like there is now of, you know, if you let your child out of sight, he or she will be kidnapped and taken to a terrible place.
Right. So not about play dates and fear, but that kind of open, free-range childhood almost, Joel. Thanks very much for calling in with that perspective. And Stephen Mintz, you know, adults of a certain age, when they talk about childhood, they make this observation again and again. It was so free then, and then, of course, now often meaning the 50s, 60s, maybe even early 70s. Is this an accurate perception? It's certainly what an awful lot of people say.
It's certainly my perspective on my own childhood, but the most striking development, I think, of the last 20 years has been what I would call the discovery of risk. Parents earlier in time didn't baby-proof their homes. Today, many parents are guilt-ridden and hovering over their children, and I must confess that I have been one of those hovering parents. That is, we're afraid of many, many things. We're afraid of abduction of our children. We're afraid of sexual abuse of our children. These fears are grossly exaggerated, but they have a real effect on parents nonetheless. And I think they have a very destructive impact on children who need opportunities for risk.
And they don't get them today. And of course, the way Joel describes it, there was a lot of fun involved with that element of risk as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Pam is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Pam. You're on the air.
Hi. Good to talk to you. I've actually been having this conversation with international consultants and university professors and senior management at Fortune 100 companies because we have been seeing that there's been a dumbing down of young people, and that even within our university systems, it's been harder and harder to get kids to work and see kids work. And in the early 70s, I was in student teaching and in the public education system, and I attribute a lot of it to the switchover in the late 60s to the self.
So, sorry, Pam, you're breaking up on us there. I wish I knew what you were attributing it to. Can you hear me? That sounds like we lost Pam's cell phone there, Stephen Mintz. But let's pick up the point that we all got there, that she perceives a dumbing down of young people. But you describe young people more thoroughly engaged in education and expectations around education, or at least being in the institution of school, maybe than ever before.
Well, one comes away with two different thoughts. I hate to leave people with contradictions, but sometimes they're real. That is, you can read letters written during the Civil War by 10-year-olds, like a young woman named Carrie Berry, who lived in Atlanta at the time of the March to the Sea. Mm. And the eloquence of these writings for someone who never attended school is simply extraordinary. Or we think of Abraham Lincoln, who didn't have a formal education, mm-hmm. Who also could write with a kind of eloquence that all of us could only envy. Yet, the flip side of this is it's easy to exaggerate the quote-unquote dumbing down of kids, since people have been charging this for the past century. Test scores are about as good as they've ever been. And that's despite the fact that a much wider range of kids are now taking the tests. What I do think we should be concerned about is what I would call the colonization of children's cultures. And what I mean by that is that television and marketers and advertisers are trying as intently as they can to capture children's cultures and to turn this into sources of profit. And they sell attitude. They sell rebelliousness, just as they would sell any other product. And it does have an effect on kids. And we cannot use V-chips to protect our children from this horrible culture, but we can prepare them better to deal with it.
We'll talk about how that could be done after a short break. Stephen Mintz, stick with us. Stephen Mintz's new book is Huck's Raft, A History of American Childhood. You can join the conversation tonight. What's the essence of a good childhood? Do kids have it today? How close? How far from it? Has the majority of any generation ever really had it? You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about growing up in America across the centuries. My guest is Stephen Mintz, professor of history at the University of Houston and author of the very interesting new book, Huck's Raft, as in Huckleberry Finn, A History of American Childhood. You can join our conversation tonight. What about today's children? Are they hothouse flowers? Are they too protected? Or are they themselves postmodern survivors? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Kevin's calling from Westford, Massachusetts. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah. Thanks for the program. It's great, great, interesting program. I wanted to make a point. We watched on PBS a show called The Frontier House.
Sure, great show.
Right, and where they went back and they tried to recreate living in colonial times and everything, and it was very difficult, and they weren't sure. Then they went back and they judged them all to see who would make it through the winter and who wouldn't. Turned out nobody was going to make it through the winter. But they interviewed the teenagers who had gone back and lived as they would have in the colonial times and everything, and they were working hard. And throughout the show, they were upset and crying, and it was hard work.
It was cold. It was dirty. It was wet. It was really hard.
And
then suddenly they were back in their beautiful California beach house.
Sitting in their hot tub, and they're asking them about their life now, and they actually said that they're bored now. They had too much to choose from. They're sitting in their beautiful California home in their hot tub, and they're saying, this life is boring. They said they actually preferred being back in the colonial times.
Kevin, I saw that, and I was struck by the very same thing. I'm curious how Stephen Mintz responds to it, but thanks for bringing it up. Stephen Mintz, this kind of goes to the heart of what you're saying. You warn us of being too nostalgic about past periods of childhood, that they had many, many difficulties themselves. And yet here are these very affluent American teenagers spending some weeks or months in a tough, almost colonial environment, and then when they're coddled again, wishing they were back there. How do you interpret that?
Kids have two roles today. They are students and they are consumers. And while some kids can adjust to those roles perfectly well, many kids find them deeply unsatisfying. And it's hard not to think that it wasn't all that long ago that there was a genuine alternative to that. 9-year-old breaker boys, that is, boys who worked in coal mines separating the slate from the coal, or newsboys who went on strike in New York in 1899. In other words, there was a sense in which kids in the past could measure their growing competence and growing maturity. There's only one way in our society to measure your growing maturity, and that's left for a very small minority of kids, and that's sports. And if you're not good at sports, and that means these days really good at sports, you exist in a kind of rolelessness that, again, is deeply unsettling for many kids.
You describe it as a deepening contradiction between the child as dependent juvenile and the child as incipient adult. What's the incipient adult part?
Well, kids are more knowledgeable. Very young kids are more knowledgeable about adult realities than I was at their age. And physically, they're maturing 1 or 2 or even 3 years earlier than their baby boomer, now grandparents.
Hitting puberty.
Right. And yet, we still define childhood in opposition to adulthood. And we expect kids not to grow up precociously. And when they do, we worry intently. But kids need to be able to demonstrate their growing maturity. If we don't allow it in constructive ways, kids will find unconstructive ways.
But surely you're not suggesting that we send the hordes of 9-year-olds back into the coal mines.
Well, let's think for a moment. Absolutely not. Don't worry. But let's think what parents who have a lot of money can do for their kids that other parents cannot do. One thing that they can do is try to arrange internships for their kids so their kids get a chance to
get that exposure, be out there in the adult world.
Right. Another thing that they do is they send their kids to summer camp because we don't want middle school or high school to be an all-encompassing social universe where it's the only thing that you can imagine in your life.
Mm-hmm.
You want to undercut that. And people who are affluent, they do that for their kids. Now, they may also do other things that I find less satisfying. That is, they may overstructure and overpressure their kids' lives.
And over-consumerize.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But I think that these other things that try to create a sense of a wider world, as you put it, are very valuable to young people.
But not available to all young people. Tracy's calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Tracy, you're on the air.
Yes, I've been listening, and it struck me that there seems to be a correlation lately between the dumbing down of America's young people that an earlier caller mentioned and this lack of risk that they have. I've noticed I have a 15-year-old, and he and others of his age, when put in a position where they are forced to deal with an unexpected situation, although he may be as educated or better educated than other 15-year-olds, 50 years ago, he has not had the opportunity to face the failure, the what do I do if situation.
Mm-hmm.
So when he's put in those situations, he does come off as he doesn't know what to do. Although he may be better book smart and has spent more time in school, but he doesn't have the coping skills because he is so insulated from having to deal with things himself.
Yeah, less time in a real unstructured environment, a challenging or risk-challenging environment. Tracy, thanks for that observation. Stephen Mintz, again, we want to be careful about judging too harshly. You warn again and again in the book that every generation has seen its kids as somehow deficient, but this theme comes up again.
Well, the path to hell is paved with good intentions, right?
Mm-hmm,
and
sure.
One of the greatest intentions of all was to give all children, regardless of social class, a right to a middle-class childhood. And after 150 years of almost countless struggles by a group of self-described child savers, they succeeded in achieving that. And yet, what I'd like to suggest is that that ideal was flawed in some ways, and it's no longer perfectly appropriate for young people today. If childhood is a changing phenomena, then we have it in our power to make childhood better. And that means not protecting, not sheltering children, but trying to reverse that process of extreme age segregation that we've embarked upon for the past 150 years.
Where they're effectively isolated from adults other than teachers and parents.
Exactly.
So how do you do that? What's your practical prescription? We've just got a couple of minutes left here, and I'm sure many parents are listening very closely, but it almost sounds like you're saying just turn Johnny or Jill out in the street.
Well,
but I'm sure you're not. What do you mean?
My mantra would be this. If you want to increase your child's academic potential and social skills and creativity and self-sufficiency, leave them alone. And what I mean by that is that unstructured play is absolutely essential for kids' growth. Limit their screen time, and I mean not just TV, and send your kids outside to play and try to find ways that you can encourage unstructured play with other children. And then also try to find ways to expose them to adults who are not you or not very close relatives.
And get a grip on the fear that comes with all of that all these days.
Exactly.
That is a large challenge. Do you see parents succeeding at this?
Well, I'm afraid we're seeing the exact opposite. We're living in a time of Amber Alerts and Megan's Laws and Children's Online Protection Acts and dress codes and V-chips and high-stakes testing. In other words, the thrust of our society, I think, is going in exactly the opposite direction. Huck Finn's raft may be our ideal, this odyssey of self-discovery and risk. But in the real world, the one you and I live in, parents are doing everything to keep that from happening.
Do your children, we've just got half a minute, do you hear children trying through that, customer culture today, trying to call out for something different?
I think very much so. I think that they've had, despite all my wife's and my efforts, a less happy childhood because a less free childhood. I am as guilty as anyone of being a hovering parent. And what I'd like to suggest is that there's different kinds of abuse in society. One kind of abuse is physical abuse, but there's also the abuse of expectations, of pushing kids beyond their capacities and imposing our dreams upon them.
Stephen Mintz, you've opened a great window for us, and we're very grateful to you for the time you spent with us tonight. Thanks for the book, and thanks for joining us this evening.
Thank you very much.
Stephen Mintz, professor of history at the University of Houston and author of the new book, Huck's Raft, A History of American Childhood. In a moment, a new novel tells a coming-of-age tale set in an age of terrorism. This is On Point. Writer Meg Rosoff's first novel is How I Live Now. It focuses on the lives of children and adolescents in an age of terrorism. The main character, Daisy, goes to visit her aunt on a farm in rural England. While she's there, London comes under terrorist attack, leaving her stranded with her four cousins and all the adults away. The four children are left to take care of themselves and to deal with a war that creeps closer and closer to their rustic refuge. The book has won the Guardian Children's Fiction Prize and has been shortlisted for Britain's Whitbread Award for Children's Literature. Tonight, Meg Rosoff reads a passage and explains why she chose adolescence as the subject of her first novel.
Well, I think the thing that interests me so much about adolescence is that it's a time where people change so extremely, and the very worst kind of people can become the very best kind of people, and the most confused can often come to some kind of an epiphany or go through a process of change. I mean, it really is possibly the time of greatest change in life and a greatest searching for clarity. So with all that metamorphosis going on, you can see it as a very dark time, but I think it's actually a really hopeful time when people can come into their own and come into a sense of their own strengths and their own ability to love, and also the redemptive power of love. And I think, you know, the writer's view always has a tendency to come through, and I'm a great optimist and a great believer in the healing power of love and of friendship and responsibility and all those sorts of things. The general feeling that comes out of the book is actually a terribly optimistic one, even though the themes are a bit on the dark side. This passage is Daisy talking about her mother's sister, and Daisy's mother died pretty much, although we never make it completely explicit, I mean, she died pretty much in childbirth, so she never really knew her mother. And this is the first time that she's met her mother's sister, and it's started her thinking about her mother, which is obviously something that pops into her head more often than she likes to admit. It was times like this when I let my guard down that Mom had a habit of strolling into my brain, even though she was dead, which made people put on this sickening pious kind of face and say, oh, I am sorry, like it was their fault. And in fact, if everyone wasn't so busy apologizing all the time about asking a perfectly normal question like, where's your mother, I might have managed to get more information out of someone other than just, she died to give you life, which is the party line on good old Mom. It's a shame starting your first day on the planet as a murderer, but there you go. I didn't have much choice at the time. Still, I could live quite happily without the labels I picked up because of it. Murderer or poor motherless lamb. Which one would you choose, the rock or the hard place? Dad was one of those never mention her name again type of fathers, which, if you ask me, was extremely unpsychologically correct of him. Leah's father worked on Wall Street and shot himself one day when he lost $600 million of someone else's money, and they never shut up about him in their house. Which, as Leah likes to point out, is not the perfect answer either. I sometimes wish someone would fill me in on the simple, boring things like, did she have big feet or wear makeup? And what was her favorite song? And did she like dogs or have a nice voice? And what books did she read, etc.? I made up my mind to ask Aunt Penn some of these questions when she came back from Oslo, but I guess what you really want to know are the things you can't ask. Like, did she have eyes like yours? And when you pushed my hair back, was that what it feels like to have your mother do it? And did her hands look quiet and serious like yours? And did she ever have a chance to look at me with a complicated expression like the one on your face? And by the way, was she scared to die? Then Edmund and Piper came and lay down on the blanket, one on either side of me, with Piper holding my hand as usual, and Isaac still standing in the water looking peaceful. And they started arguing about what flies trout like best in a quiet, lazy sort of way. And Edmund blew smoke rings in the air, and I closed my eyes and wished they were mine.
Meg Rosoff, reading from her first novel, How I Live Now. It was announced today that the book has been shortlisted for Britain's prestigious Whitbread Award for Children's Literature. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.